Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Catholic Answers Live, Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett, who will be back on Wednesday. Tomorrow, your special guest is Thomas, the TikTok engine. My guest today, Joe Heschmeyer, Ask Me Anything. Joe, you and Cy Kellett and I, about a year from now, a little bit less, are going to cruise the Catholic Rhineland on a specially chartered boat. That is, the whole of the boat is going to be owned for 12 days or whatever it is. I don't know if owned is technically the right word, but we will be the only ones on there, so we can pretend it's ours. We've charted it. We did this with the Danube back in 2020. The whole boat was Catholic Answers. My friends, I encourage you to come along. CatholicCruise.com. We start in Amsterdam. We end in Basel. We have 12 ports of call, including Cologne, and where there's a magnificent cathedral, actually several magnificent cathedrals. Aachen, we're going to go to, the home of Charlemagne. There's so much Catholic history in the Rhine Valley. Hildegard of Bingen, we're going to see her, the great doctress of the church. We're going to see the Strasbourg Cathedral. As I say, this region is rich with Catholic history, beautiful sites. See it in the company of other Catholics who love the work of Catholic Answers and who love Jesus Christ. Our chaplain is the great Father Sebastian Walsh of St. Michael's Abbey, the Norbertines just up the street, whom you know is a regular guest here on Catholic Answers Live. I think we've already sold about 50 spaces already, and this boat is not that big. So CatholicCruise.com. Everything is included in your price, all your shore excursions, your meals, your drinks, all the lectures, onshore masses. Of course, you don't have to pay to go to Mass, I know, but we've arranged for wonderful onshore masses. So CatholicCruise.com. Don't delay signing up. Joe, I know you're looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's going to be a beautiful experience. And Father Sebastian Walsh is incredible. He just blessed the home of my brother and sister-in-law over the weekend, and they were talking about what a joy it was to be with him just for a little bit of time there. So being able to be with him for an extended period of time is well worth the travel.
And imagine 12 days with Joe Heschmeyer and Cy Kellett.
And you can go to confession when you need to.
Yeah. Not to Joe Heschmeyer.
No, not to Joe Heschmeyer, thankfully.
John in Oklahoma, listening on Sirius 130 EWTN satellite radio. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. You there, John? There you go. Good.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What's your question, brother?
Okay. So I got a dilemma here.
Sure.
Just found out that, okay, now the person who, and I'm still new at this, so the person that does the singing and stuff, that's the cantor, correct?
The cantor, yep.
Correct.
Okay. Just found out that the cantor in our parish is openly homosexual.
Mm.
How do we, does that take away from the Mass, the authority of the Mass? Is there something, you know, should I not worry about it since apparently the priest is okay with it? I don't know, because I'm kind of bothered by it. It's like, okay, wait a minute.
Yeah,
sure. We can help.
Is this invalidating the Mass?
We can help.
It doesn't invalidate the Mass. It can cause some scandal because it can make it look like this is not a big moral issue. This is one of those areas where the cantor isn't in the same kind of liturgical position as, say, the priest, but is nevertheless doing something in an official liturgical capacity. It's different than just somebody in the pews. You know, if the person next to you in the pews who happens to be singing is living a sinful lifestyle, irrelevant. That doesn't, you know, that we want them there. They shouldn't go for communion, but we want them to be present at the Mass, and that's good and beautiful. But someone who's in a cantoring position or in the choir, it gets into more of an official kind of position. And so then you are representing the church more. And as a result, someone living in a way radically contrary to the church, there is more of a scandal with it. And so I would absolutely say something about it to the pastor. I mean, I strongly suspect the pastor already knows about this, but trying to understand at a deeper level, like why they're okay with this can be very important. In terms of the validity of the Mass, that doesn't impact the validity at all. It can be distracting. It can be a little bit scandalous, but you still have a valid Mass there. But I do think it is a situation worth confronting. And because the other thing that comes up, you will have people, particularly at like high holidays, where you might have different instruments and everything at Mass that aren't normally there, like violinists and the like. You will sometimes have people who aren't practicing Christians at all, or at least they're not Catholic, and they are often living lifestyles that aren't in keeping with the gospel. And so it does happen from time to time, but a cantor, because they are sort of the voice of the congregation and the singing, I think it is more of a scandal there and might be worth addressing.
How's that, John? Is that helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can always leave it up to Joe to explain stuff to where I can understand it.
I'm grateful.
That's an important skill for an apologist. Good, good, good. Thanks, John. Call back anytime. Eliza in New Jersey, watching on the Catholic Answers YouTube channel. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi. I just want to say thank you for the show and everyone in the comments and the mods. Y'all are all so great.
Glory.
Yes. Big Stack is doing some great work. I know moderating. I never really get a chance to call out the moderators, but I don't even think Big Stack is Catholic yet, but does a great job moderating several Catholic shows. And, you know, God's going to do what he's going to do.
He is irresistible.
For sure.
So how can we help, Eliza?
That kind of came up. Oh, excuse me.
Yep.
At church the other day, we were talking about confession, and I recognized that in Scripture, the examples of women, it's kind of like Jesus calling out women and not them confessing. So I'm wondering about the history of the church when women started receiving the sacrament of confession.
Well, are you including the woman at the well there?
Yes.
Okay. It seemed to me like he confronts her a little bit, but he seems fairly gentle in terms of, like he lets her know he knows. And then she is able to kind of open up to him at a deeper level. So yeah, the very early history of confession, it was originally done publicly, but as far as we can tell, it's always been both men and women. Even if the particular examples we might have in the New Testament, there aren't a ton of examples given of anybody, but the particular examples we have are of men. Nevertheless, both men and women confessed their sins, and seemingly both men and women were going to John the Baptist. This is one of those things where we hear more about the men. There's a line in the Gospel of Matthew when he's describing the feeding of the 5,000, and he says there were 5,000 there, not counting women and children. And so he's nodding to the fact that most of the way ancient writings worked focused on the man, and particularly on adult men, but that doesn't exclude the real lived spiritual experiences of women and children who just aren't given the same sort of narrative focus. And so we have every reason to believe men, women, and children were all listening to Jesus. Men, women, and children were responding to the gospel, including confessing their sins, and were being saved and being brought into this. And we can even point to several women who seem to have had this experience, who have become transformed and become disciples of Jesus. We just aren't given the same level of detail kind of about what their conversion experience looked like.
Is that helpful?
Okay, great.
Eliza, good.
Helpful. I love confession. It's like my favorite sacrament. So
wonderful. That's such a good thing for people to hear, too.
Yes. Yeah.
Tertullian and On Repentance, one of our earliest sources that talks about the practice of confession, he gives some examples of women. I don't remember if he gives any examples of women as penitents, but he at least gives some feminine examples when he's talking about it more broadly. So it seems to point to the fact that men and women were confessing from the beginning.
Eliza, call back anytime. Michael in Los Angeles, California, watching on Catholic.com. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're well.
Good, how are you?
Good. I was wondering, I'm a former Protestant Catholic revert. I was wondering if you might do more Protestant or Catholic Orthodox apologetics in the future, as like I've talked to a lot of Orthodox and a lot of the issues they bring up accuse Catholics of falling into serious, like grave error, such as like absolute divine simplicity leading to pantheism, or very complicated, like complex bedrock theology issues like that, in that like our faith is essentially invalid completely if we believe the things we believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a very good question. I've thought about doing an episode basically like why I'm not Eastern Orthodox. I haven't done much so far for a few reasons. One, there's just fewer kind of challenges from the Orthodox side. And there, I mean, certainly there are way more Protestants than there are Orthodox in the part of the country that I live in, and in fact, in the country that I live in. But two, the issues are also often very kind of niche and in the weeds. Like people who believe absolute divine simplicity leads to pantheism. Number one, that's a vanishingly small number of people. And I don't think even most ordinary Orthodox actually think Catholics and Protestants and historic theists are all pantheists. I think this is a grave misunderstanding of what absolute divine simplicity entails, because you would have to say most theists in history have not really been theists. They've been pantheists. And that's such an obviously sort of absurd conclusion, that the idea that you need like essence and energy as distinction before you can have theism seems obviously wrong. And like the East would have to discard many of its own saints from the first 1,000 years as actually pantheists. So there's, you know, all of those kind of big issues. And in fact, one of the things I'm planning on saying in the half-written episode I have in my head of why I'm not Eastern Orthodox is I think the Catholic side can much more easily incorporate Eastern saints from early Christianity into Catholic theology without it seeming like a stretch, whereas many times Orthodoxy looks like just Eastern Orthodoxy, as if the Western saints for the first 1,000 years don't count. And if you don't have them as part of your patrimony, you're not really breathing with both lungs. Whereas I think the Catholic Church breathes with both lungs. And you see from the very earliest days, you get people like St. Irenaeus, who grows up in the East in Smyrna and becomes bishop in the West. And he talks about the importance of agreeing with the Church of Rome in the 100s. If your vision of the church doesn't do justice to that, it's not just a distortion of the last 1,000 years. It's a distortion of the last 2,000 years.
Michael, do you have the book, The Catholic Answers, published a little more than a year ago by Michael Lafton called Answering Orthodoxy?
I do not.
No. All right. Well, why don't you stay on the line and give your address to Siobhan, and we will send you a copy of it. I think Michael did a superb job with this book. You know, but before Michael, there was... James Lacutis for many years was very good on this, but it really required a lot of updating and because as Joe was saying, new sort of niche or obscure arguments, and Michael picks up many that were completely unknown to me. I highly recommend this book to anyone who finds himself in conversations with Orthodoxy or just simply wants to understand that, because I know Joe, and you move in this world much more than I do, the ortho bros, if it were, if you will, rather.
I'm genuinely astonished you even know that term.
Well, I'm so hip, Joe, and down with the times. But anyway, right, they're called the ortho bros, aren't they?
Yes.
A thing?
There are a lot of
online,
particularly Protestant converts to Orthodoxy, who spend a lot of time online. And this is a problem that the Orthodox have acknowledged, you know, people who spend a lot of time watching other Orthodox bros online and maybe not a lot of time actually getting involved at their local parish or learning the patrimony of a church they've been adopted into. And they're often kind of vociferously anti-Catholic and in a way that can look more like a Protestant who discovered they didn't have a liturgical tradition,
right,
but were too opposed to Catholicism to just go all the way. So they became Orthodox.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to be uncharitable to them, but there is a grave lack of charity and depth of formation and spiritual growth that you find in some of those quarters that I don't think is faithful to historic orthodoxy. And so I think it's kind of a different phenomenon, distinguishing ortho bros from, you know, the historic orthodox.
Nonetheless, they are kind of the growing cultural presence, I guess you could say.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Answering Orthodoxy by Catholic Answers Press, and Michael will be happy to send you a copy of that. My friends, we're going to take a quick break. Before I do, I want to invite all of you to join us September 25 to 28 here in San Diego for the Catholic Answers Conference. Go make disciples. We are going to learn, all of us, how to be better at evangelizing, because when we die, God is going to ask us, what did you do to tell the world about my son? And you don't want to get caught off. You don't want to be able to say, I didn't do anything. And then our Lord will say, well, he told you to. It's going to go something like that. So join us. Go make disciples, September 25 to 28, here in San Diego. Chris Stefanik, David Anders, Amy Hamilton, Steve Dawson, Paul Check, Father Paul Check, and all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Save $50 off your conference registration by using the promo code Early. And that just means this is like the early bird rate, so it's not going to be forever. I don't know when it ends, but through the end of July, 1 month. Wow. Save $50. CatholicAnswersConference.com. Right back after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
This is Jim Pinto, Director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN Media Missionaries prayerfully take EWTN to parishes and the community through the print and electronic media we provide. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
Catholic Answers Live, 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer, my guest, Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett, who will be back on Wednesday. Levi in Louisiana, watching on the Catholic Answers YouTube channel. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I have questions. See if I could get some advice or tips.
Sure.
About a strange sequence of events that occurred to me about a week ago at a retreat. I need to discern whether or not this is a coincidence or something
supernatural,
else, something mystical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if needed, I can provide some more details, or if you have any opening advice.
Okay, so you're just wondering in general what principles to look for?
What's that?
Are you asking for general principles of what to look for in figuring out if something was miraculous or not? Or mystical?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily miraculous. It's just a very strange sequence of events that occurred over 3 days on my trip. That seemed to be related to a prayer that I asked for something
to
be revealed.
Oh, sure. Good.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where you may never know with infallible certainty that God arranged this on purpose, but he has certainly presented you with a series of events that have led you to believe something might have been miraculous, might have been the hand of God. So if the conclusion is you're being led into a deeper love of God and into greater charity, then you should accept it And it's okay if, you know, at the end of your life, it turns out it's just a random coincidence. There's nothing bad that has resulted from that. On the other hand, if you have an experience and it's encouraging you to something that is contrary to the faith, it's encouraging you to sin or to schism or to something like this, then, or, you know, some new revelation that doesn't match with what God has given us publicly, those are certain signs that it is not of God and you should reject it. But as long as what you're being given makes you believe more deeply in the love of God and of the way you've been called to grow as a saint, then I would take it seriously. If you want more certain knowledge about it, the other thing you can do is you can ask a priest to serve as a spiritual director to you, or sometimes a qualified lay person, there are times where laity are trained in the principles of spiritual mentorship, and then have them kind of walk through with you the discernment process to see what evidence do we have that this might be of God, and what evidence do we have that this might just be a coincidence or of man or God forbid, of the enemy.
What do you think, Levi?
Okay, yeah, thank you. That's helpful. Yeah, I do believe it was something leading me towards God, something of a good nature, a good spirit.
Good.
Well, I mean, I would take that seriously.
Yeah, the whole situation just left me really confused.
Yeah.
Because it was not what I was expecting.
Levi,
are you familiar with the rules for discernment of St. Ignatius?
Yes.
Okay, well, yeah, he gives 14 rules for discernment of spirits. And those can be a good thing to take a look at, to see kind of broadly, like, okay, does it appear that I'm listening to the right voice or does it appear that I'm not?
Levi, if I can recommend another resource to you, our friends Dan and Stephanie Burke at the Avila Institute are very good on discernment of spirits, interior life, spiritual direction, and visiting their website, and they even have online communities, perhaps getting involved in one of them, I think could be helpful to you in this regard. And then the other thing that I would say is, and Joe's recommendation for those Ignatian rules, the more you sit with our Lord in front of the Blessed Sacrament quietly, the more he's going to make plain to you what it is he has in mind. And on his schedule, for sure. Yeah, it'll be revealed, and it sounds like good fruit will come from it.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Call back anytime, Levi. Mike in Massachusetts, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Mike, thanks for downloading on the Catholic Answers app, and I have great news. There is a whole new Catholic Answers app that's coming very soon, and it's going to make this app that you're currently using look like it was from the 13th century. So stand by. Welcome, Mike.
Those old 13th century apps were terrible.
I know. They're very clumsy. Yeah.
Took forever to crochet.
Buggy. Yeah. Mike, how can we help? Mike in Massachusetts.
Yep. Can you hear me?
We can.
Now we can.
All right. Yeah, great. So I have a question. So I'll give you the question and then maybe some context. The question is, can an ecumenical council change doctrine in a way that creates a liturgical abuse? And if so, wouldn't that contradict Matthew 18 about loosening on earth is then loosened in heaven? And the context to that is I was listening to a podcast where a priest was explaining his opinion that receiving on the hand was a liturgical abuse, and that some Catholic mystics have had visions of purgatory where the bishops that approved this were in purgatory because of this. Now, I know that's all personal revelation, but it got me thinking of that question.
Okay, so there's a couple things to know there. Number one, you can't change doctrine. What you're describing is in technical parlance called the discipline, like a practice, because you know something can't go from true to untrue or vice versa. You can define doctrine more clearly, but you can't just like change it. You know, when we talk about development of doctrine, we talk about the truth coming into greater clarity, not just like a, you know, X is now not X. So this practice and liturgical practices more broadly typically involve discipline. We, you know, a church practice And discipline is connected to dogma, but it's not the same thing. Second, Vatican II doesn't actually say anything about receiving communion in the hand as opposed to on the tongue. This is a practice that originated after Vatican II and was originally combated by the church and then eventually was permitted. If you go back to the early church, people did receive in the hand. So it was a pious devotion that arose to receive on the tongue that then became church law, that then people started to flaunt the church law and receive in the hand again, and then eventually church law was relaxed. But this is a matter of church law, not the working of an ecumenical council. So just to be kind of clear on all of that, it is possible for a discipline to be more or less conducive to holiness. And some of that might be hard to analyze, and none of that involves infallibility. So the First Council of Nicaea, for instance, forbade kneeling on Sundays or during the Easter season. That's because in the East, kneeling is more of a sign of penitence, whereas in the West, kneeling is more of a sign of adoration. So someone could say they like or don't like that liturgical practice derived from the council, but that wouldn't be an issue of infallibility.
Mike, I'm afraid that is the hard break. Catholic Answers Live, 888. What's the number, Joe? 888-318-7884. Right back after this.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Catholic Answers Live, 888-318-7884. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett. Tony in California, watching on the Catholic Answers YouTube channel. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is about Eucharistic miracles and, you know, just miracles in general. So I know the Catholic Church is famous for having all these miracles, but then I also see these miracles happen in other churches, such as the Eastern Orthodox, the Oriental Orthodox, and even some Protestant mm-hmm. churches. I mean, like, the Eastern Orthodox churches have Eucharistic miracles, and, you know, even some Marian apparitions, like in Zaytun, for example. Mm-hmm. There was even an Anglican church in Arkansas that had a Eucharistic miracle a few years ago. So, it's kind of get mixed messages when I see that, because, like, on one hand, we know that the Catholic Church is the one true church. But on the other hand, you know, we see all these churches that also experience these miracles. So, like, if the Catholic Church is the one true church and there's generally, like, no salvation outside of it, why do we see these types of miracles happening in these other churches as well?
We can help, Tony.
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing I'd say is it's a much bigger problem for someone who's not Catholic, particularly a Protestant, to explain why do Catholics have Eucharistic miracles than it would be for a Catholic to explain, like, why does an Orthodox have Eucharistic miracles? The one Anglican case you talked about, as far as I know, we just have to go off the word of the Anglican priest there. So I want to set that to one side. It doesn't appear to be one that was investigated in any way. But the Eucharistic miracles in the Catholic Church, you know, have actually been investigated and submitted to scientific scrutiny. And, you know, you have, like, heart tissue appearing and the like.
And Joe, sometimes the church says, oh, no, a miracle has not happened.
Right.
Here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. You can have things that look like a miracle that are not. And so one of the reasons this mattered is not because I'm accusing anybody of bad faith, is you can believe something is miraculous. It turns out not to be. And if it's not investigated, it's hard for anyone just hearing it secondhand or thirdhand to know what to make of it. But we could say at a broad level, the Catholic Church believes that God is present and active in the spiritual lives of all Christians, whether they're fully incorporated in the church or not. And so he probably does do supernatural things. There's nothing contrary to Catholicism as saying any of that. Now, all spiritual gifts are oriented, as St. Paul points out in Ephesians, towards the unity of the body. So someone getting spiritual gifts, it should not be a cause for factionalization of, oh, I've got this gift, so therefore I'm special and don't need church unity, the way the church in Corinth kind of went for a while until St. Paul started cracking some knuckles. But rather, it should be as St. Paul says, as I say in Ephesians 4, I believe, that the gifts are given for the building up of the body. And so whatever gifts God has given, natural, supernatural, miraculous, are oriented towards our unity. So we would also say, on top of that, that the Eucharist in an Eastern Orthodox Church is a valid Eucharist. And again, this should orient us towards full communion. It is scandalous that you can receive Jesus in the Eucharist in a Catholic Church, an Orthodox Church, an Oriental Orthodox Church, and that we're not all one the way we're meant to be. That the Eucharist should be a source of unity for us. And this is something that the Catholic Church has said emphatically and repeatedly. So if you're Orthodox and believe that the Catholic priests don't have valid sacraments, then the fact that we have a Eucharistic miracle pretty well debunks that. On the other hand, the fact that a Catholic person believes God is present, including sacramentally present, in an Orthodox church, nothing about that is challenged by a Eucharistic miracle. It's only reaffirming what we already believe, which is Jesus does show up in the Divine Liturgy, whether the celebrant is in communion with the Bishop of Rome or not. So all of those miracles taken together, it seems to me, point to the validity of Orthodox and Catholic sacraments, which is what Catholics claim, not what Orthodox typically claim. And certainly not what Protestants typically claim. So I think the miraculous case points very heavily in the Catholic direction. To deny that, you would seemingly have to say not one of the purported Eucharistic miracles and Marian apparitions is real. And I don't think the people making those claims have taken any time to closely analyze even the major ones to see if that's true.
How's that, Tony?
Awesome. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Call back. Tony, you're not so far away. You should, California's a big state. I don't know where you are, but make sure you come to our conference in September.
Oh, you know what? If I can add one thing, I don't think we have this book, so I can't offer it to you. But Father George Eliot and Stacy Trisankos, who you sometimes hear on this show, co-wrote a book called Behold, It Is I, Tradition and Science on the Real Presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And they have a section in there where they take a pretty critical investigation of purported Eucharistic miracles. And some they are just thinking this probably isn't real, and some they think it is. So it's a different approach than I've seen from a lot of books on the Eucharist, and that it spends more time on the miraculous side.
888-318-7884. Let's go to Keel in Cleveland, Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Keel, if you ever find yourself without your Catholic Answers app, there's a great Catholic network, The Rock, in Cleveland, so tune them in as well. How can we help?
Thank you. Yes, I did discover The Rock, and it's right there on my radio all the time.
Oh, good. Praise God. They do great work.
They do, just like you guys.
I missed what you said just a second ago.
Oh, just about The Rock, that I am so grateful for the Cleveland radio station. I have a question as a recovering Calvinist about Matthew 11:27, where Jesus says that he alone knows the Father. And, you know, I don't have it in front of me right now, but he talks about that he
I do.
Chooses.
He says, all things have been delivered to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him.
Yeah, there's that word choose, you know, so like Calvinist background is like, see, there you go, there it is.
Well, I mean, we would say all of that as Catholics, that anytime someone comes to the knowledge of God, that this is first because God has been present in their life. Because you can have a kind of an experience where you feel like, aha, one day I just woke up and I had this brilliant idea to learn about God, and then I entered in a relationship with him, and I did it, and I did it, and I did it. But in reality, in what's called the priority of grace, even the desire to learn about God is coming from God. And so the thing Matthew 11 is pointing out is all of this is coming from the Father through the Son. And so everyone who's ever been saved, no matter how much it felt like their initiative, it was always God's initiative. Now, that doesn't mean, and also there's some people God doesn't want to save. That doesn't follow at all from Matthew 11:27. It just means that everyone who is saved because God reached out to them first, not because they reached out to God first. Does that part make sense? Think about it like this, an elevator.
Well, yeah.
Like it was an elevator, you can't get up, you know, to the 27th floor on your own. You need the elevator. But let's say you jump off the elevator. That's not the elevator deciding it doesn't like you, or the elevator deciding it doesn't want to take you up to the 27th floor. So we want to reject the idea that we can choose to ascend to God merely on our own effort. That is something the church really strongly rejects. All of this has to be the result of divine initiative. And yet we also want to acknowledge that even though we can't save ourselves, we can damn ourselves. We can take the initiative to reject the elevator. We can take the initiative to jump off the elevator. But we can't take the initiative to bring ourselves up to the 27th floor by jumping really high or something like that.
What do we think, Kiel?
That makes sense. But where I stumble is the fact that it sounds like Jesus, if he's saying he chooses to reveal the Father to some, then that kind of implies that he also chooses not to reveal him to others.
Well, not in an absolute sense. Think about the parable of the talents. We do want to say that he gives more to some people, but even in the parable of the talents, one gets five, one gets two, one gets one, nobody gets none. No one, like the reason St. Paul can say that even the pagan Gentiles are without excuse is because they've received tremendous gifts from God. A talent is an enormous sum of money. And so, which is why, again, quoting that line in Romans 10, he can say there's no one who hasn't heard the good news in some sense because God's voice has gone out through all the world. And
okay, so
this means that...
You're saying that Jesus is responding to those who have responded to God's overtures.
Well, Jesus can give more grace to one person than to another. So, for instance, the Virgin Mary is prevented from having original sin through no merit of her own, through an act called prevenient grace. You and I were not given that. Now, in God's mercy, he can give more to one person than to another. In God's justice, he judges each of us based on the gifts that he did give us, and no one is judged based on gifts they did not receive. So the person who gets one talent is expected to have two. The person who gets five is expected to have 10. If the person who starts with five rolls in with two, that's not good. Like in the parable of the talents, the guy who's criticized starts with one talent, and that's not the thing he's criticized for. He's criticized for not turning that one talent into two talents and burying it instead, not for the fact that God the master chose to give him one talent instead of five.
He was even called wicked, wasn't he?
He was wicked and slothful because he buried the talent he was given.
Right. Okay. Well, that, yeah. Okay.
I mean, think about it in terms of spiritual gifts. Like every individual spiritual gift, there's some people who are better at it than other people. And so some people are better at theology. Some people are more naturally prayerful. Some people are more likely to have a mystical experience, whatever it is. Some people, you know, they get some things about the faith more easily. They are maybe immune from certain spiritual battles, whatever it is. One person might have a very different experience than another person. And God allows all that to happen. He allows one person to be free of a spiritual struggle that someone else is burdened with. But in God's justice, he doesn't judge you based on your neighbor. He judges you based on how he has presented himself to you and the gifts and talents that he's given to you.
Okay. Yes, that makes a lot more sense.
Keel, please give your mailing address to Siobhan, if you will. Our colleague Carla Broussard has taken up the question of election. I can't remember which one it is in his two books about conversations with Protestants. I'm going to send you both, and call back anytime. Rich in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you for taking my call. So this is another literary question from like the lady in the first hour. I'm reading a book that's set in like 12th or 13th century Norway, and the protagonist of the book
Kristin Lovren's daughter?
Well, it's the same author. This is
Master of Hesia.
Olaf Odinson.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sure.
So anyway, the protagonist in the book commits a murder, and he's afraid to confess it to the priest for one of two reasons. Either the priest would, as his penance, force him to admit it publicly, or might even reveal it himself. And I know under modern church law, the priest could not reveal it himself. So I was wondering, curious, like, could this ever have been something to be worried about? And could even a modern-day priest enforce, even though he wouldn't reveal it, could he enforce a public revelation as part of your penance?
Yeah, good.
Yeah. Yeah. So I believe Gratian's Decretals in the 12th century are where that sacramental seal comes in. So broadly speaking, the history goes like this. Sacramental confession in the early church was originally public. You would confess your sins before the congregation, and you would have public penance, and there were various forms of public penance, and they were often quite severe. You might be barred from the sacraments for 3 years, for instance, and you would be forced to leave partway through the liturgy. You could go to the liturgy of the word, but then you were forced to leave for the liturgy of the Eucharist. And so you would have, for things like apostasy and adultery and the like, not all sins were treated that harshly, but there was a real seriousness around the issue of sin at a time when we were building martyrs. And so we took the problem of even small sins quite seriously. But one of the unintended side effects of this is people were sometimes afraid of going to confession. They didn't want to announce to the whole congregation the sin that they'd fallen into. And so originally arising both in the East and in Ireland in the monasteries, you have the origins of private confession, where you would simply, like the monks would beat their breast to signal that they had something to confess, and then they would go and confess it individually with the abbot. There wasn't the expectation of total privacy, though. It could still be revealed. And that changes, I believe, in the 12th century with Gratian's Decretals, that they create a duty that the priest may not betray the things revealed into him either by word or by sign, what's been revealed in confession. So it sounds like the book you're reading is right around the time that this change is becoming the norm.
Okay, Rich?
Yep. And then in the modern world...
Joe's, there's the second question. Could a priest withhold absolution in a case like this or something?
Oh, I'm sorry. I totally missed the question. The priest can only withhold absolution if he thinks you're not penitent. And confession publicly can be a sign of penance, but is not by itself. Like, the priest can't make your penance to be go and tell everyone the thing that you did. Because if you are contrite for your sin, that is what's needed for you to receive absolution. And he's not to withhold it in those cases. The other thing I should add, I'm sorry.
So that's what I assumed, but I was kind of curious.
Good. Rich.
Yeah, I mean, if someone is particularly doing like a habitual sin, and they're not, you know, like if it's a crime and they're not turning themselves in, or they're not telling their wife or whatever else, those might be signs that they're not very contrite, and the priest should probably take that as a cue to take a deeper investigation as to whether they are in fact contrite for their sin, and he can give counsel encouraging them, but he can't force them to do that. It has to still be a free act of their will. The other thing I wanted to make sure I added, and kind of I gave a very brief sketch of the history of confession. The Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 talks about the sacramental seal as well. So it's not just like medieval canon law.
Laura, Billy, Michael, Mary, right back after this.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Catholic Answers Live. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett. My friends, we got less than 10 minutes and four questions to answer. Laura in North Carolina watching on the Catholic Answers YouTube app. How can we help?
Thank you, Chris. So, Joe, my dilemma at my parish church is that very often, and maybe even most of the time, when pre-rosary is happening before Mass or even the start of Mass, I hear chatter. I typically sit at the very back near the doors to the sanctuary. I hear chatter having nothing to do with the services going on and typically coming from one of the prominent service groups affiliated with the church. And so my question is sort of two parts. Am I just being Miss Fussy Pants to be troubled by this? And if yes, fine, I'll take that, fully accept that answer from you. If not, can you recommend how, with whom, and when, and in what manner I could bring this up for a remedy?
Sure.
Yeah, there's two things we have to distinguish. One is chatter during Mass, and the other is chatter before Mass, but near the church. For the before Mass, just sit further away from the door. I mean, honestly, depending on how your church is set up, frequently there are things like offices or other space that might be in the narthex, and it's probably not going to be realistic to have people be completely quiet. And so there, unfortunately, you've got different people who are using the church in different ways. If there is regularly a problem. I mean, again, it depends a lot on the letter of the church. It might be that it's inappropriate to be having a conversation because you're in a sacred space. But usually the narthex is kind of dual use. It is kind of in between place between the outside world and entering into the church. And so you have a certain amount of conversation that's going to happen there. But during Mass, certainly, it's not appropriate to be having conversations that's, you know, audible within the church itself. And I think it's perfectly fine in those cases to talk first to maybe the priest to just say, could you put up a sign or maybe make a general announcement so nobody individually is being called out, but people can be reminded that this is a sacred space and we want to respect the liturgy. But other than that, again, you know, a certain amount of the noise is just going to happen either way. And you might just be better served either by having a one-on-one conversation or by putting yourself in a place where you are further from the noise.
Okay, Laura?
Yes, and so I'm hearing if I decide that it's worth bringing up, I'm hearing you saying fine to go straight to the priest.
Yeah, it is. You're not trying to pick on anybody in particular. You're trying to help a general rule for the parish itself. And so this is different than saying Mrs. Smith is a real problem. It's more just like there is generally a parish problem with noise that you perceive, and therefore the priest is qualified to answer that more than any individual is.
Yeah. God bless you, Laura.
Super. Thanks very much.
Take care. Call back anytime. Bet. Billy in Texas, watching on the Catholic Answers YouTube channel. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
With the Catholic Church recognizing that ghosts are real, I was wondering, does the Catholic Church have any stance on if fairies are real? Or is it
no.
something from stories
this,
Ella
this is
made
a great
up?
Question.
Go ahead. Go ahead, John.
So the part of the question is figuring out what you mean by fairies. Like, what kind of beings are they? You know, are these very small material beings? Are they spiritual beings, et cetera? And certainly you can find plenty of Christians historically who took the existence of beings like fairies for granted. The church doesn't have an explicit position on them. I think it's probably fair to say most people today, Catholic or not, don't believe in fairies. And we don't want – it does create certain theological problems if they're individual rational creatures that – are not angels or demons or ghosts that are something else. We don't have a real clear taxonomy for them, whether they're material or invisible, but it doesn't seem insurmountable. You could still have them be spiritual beings, like a different, you know, you have angels and archangels and thrones and dominions and powers and principalities. Fairies aren't mentioned there, but it wouldn't be impossible. Origen has a reference.
Well, if they are neutral spirits, are they capable of being saintly or repenting in a way?
This is a great question. So Origen talks about individual husbandmen and guardians that help in the natural world. And he says, we deny that these invisible agents are demons. And so he thinks that there are these invisible spiritual beings, but they're not demonic. But this question of, are they benevolent or malevolent comes up, because those are really the two categories. The idea of them being just like a third neutral thing is harder to square with the Christian worldview. I would say not impossible. I know a Catholic family that really wants to affirm the existence of fairies. I'm actually going over there after this show. So they'll be happy to hear that you asked this. But I'm dubious of fairies, partly because I don't see a way of neatly fitting them into a Catholic worldview if they are not angels or fallen angels, but are something else instead.
Billy, I'm going to try to get one more question in. Call back anytime. Mary in Seattle, Washington, watching on the Catholic Answers YouTube channel. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Mary, please be quick and we'll answer your question.
Hi. So my question is about dying in a state of mortal sin. So, and by the way, thank you for the show. I love the show. So,
Lori.
Basically, the idea is that, like, if someone you know dies in the state of mortal sin, the church teaches that they will, you know, someone dying in the state of mortal sin they'll go to hell. But then the church also teaches that we shouldn't despair over anyone's salvation, and that we don't really know if anyone's in hell, and we can't confirm if anyone's in hell. And so my question is kind of like, it seems kind of contradictory.
We got it, Mary. We've got it.
Yeah. Yep. So paragraph 2283 of the Catechism talks about this in the context of those who commit suicide. Suicide is a grave evil, but the people who do grave evil are sometimes not in a place where they are mentally with it enough to be morally responsible for the evil that they do. And so the Catechism says we shouldn't despair of the eternal salvation of persons who've taken their own lives by ways known to him alone, God can provide the opportunity for salutary repentance. The church prays for persons who've taken their own lives. And I would extend that to all sins. You may know the thing that they did was evil. You don't know their heart to know if they did it freely and knowledgeably. God alone knows that. And so we pray for them, even if they've done something gravely wrong.
Michael in Alton, Illinois, send an email to radio@catholic.com, and we'll send you some things to read about Enoch and Elijah. Joe, great job. Always a joy to be with you. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett. Thomas Graff tomorrow. God bless you all. 22 hours? What is it? 22 hours. We'll see you then.
Yeah, 22 more hours.